The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector on News Dissector Radio here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Heard every week, Fridays, 1 o'clock at this time in the East, but available around the world online. A podcast is also on iTunes. It's available widely on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. So welcome one more week. Take a deep breath because there's been a lot going on. As you know, the killing of Bin Laden, I call it the liquidation. Is topping the news still, the new details coming out, disputing old details and the like. And we'll talk a little bit about that later in the program because we're going to be hearing from one of the world's greatest global adventurers. His name is Robert Young Pelton. Pelton was in my film WMD. He was in Afghanistan in that first battle at Marif el-Sharif, where the prison was taken over. The prisoners were basically murdered by the Afghan soldiers in the Northern Alliance, and the soldiers basically aided and supported by Pakistan. It was one of the bloody beginnings of the whole Afghan war. He was a witness there. He met John Walker Lind, the American who was taken prisoner there. He has personal experiences from the world of covert action. His website is comebackalive.com. I mean, this is a truly amazing guy, and we're going to be hearing from him at 1:30. So stay with us here. You'll also have a chance to call him and to call us at 888-874-4888. That's our call-in line, our toll-free number, 888-874-4888. So there's a lot to talk about today, and we're going to introduce you to one of America's most dynamic labor organizers, a real leader with a vision for what labor should be doing in this period, who's been fighting corporations with various corporate campaigns. He almost created the corporate campaign, and you'll meet him in a minute, too, along with a filmmaker who's making a film about Ray Rogers, who's our guest here today. And you're going to have a chance to become a producer of that film by donating money. And we're going to tell you how. We're going to have a little bit of a radiothon, see if we can raise any money to help complete this film about Ray and his work. And it's a really amazing story, and you'll hear more about it in a minute. But first, we're going to be starting this segment on labor and workers with a new song by Tom Morello called Union Town. And this is in Ray's honor, Nancy's honor, for being here. Tom, get your guitar strung up, man. Let's do it.
Dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
It's a union town all down the line. I was speaking to people here in New York, some working people, saying, you know, the power of the unions in New York are being destroyed by the Bloomberg administration. So this is an issue that's very timely. It's very relevant. It's not just Wisconsin. It's nationwide as workers continue to fight for their rights and also fight for our rights, to protect ourselves from corporations that are extremely abusive. So Nancy Sisel is here in the studio with me. She's a filmmaker. She was a photographer at the New York Times, mighty New York Times. She was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize back in 2001, World Trade Center events, which we are now coming to commemorate 10 years later. President Obama was in New York just yesterday honoring the 9/11 survivors. One of them is Nancy here, who was actually shooting, if you will, or helping bring us information about what was really happening there. Now Nancy is changing modes. She's become a filmmaker, and she's working on a film about Ray Rogers. So, Nancy, why Ray Rogers? Why this film? Why do you think it's important now?
Hi, Danny. Thanks for inviting me in. I met Ray 25 years ago when I was a photography student at School of Visual Arts in New York. I saw on the news that National Guard had been called out to break the Hormel workers' strike, and I thought that was incredible, and I met somebody who introduced me to a person that was working with Ray, and I went out to photograph the strike. When I got to Minnesota, to Austin, Ray was working with the P9 local union, and he was in jail. So I actually didn't get to meet him for a couple of weeks, and I stayed there about 5-6 weeks in zero degree weather, photographing the strike, and was just amazed at the dedication of everybody involved. It was really like a parallel city. And I think it was a real introduction to activism for me, and something that I'm from New York. I'm from the Bronx, so I had never seen
I'm from the Bronx, too. I'll have to
I'd never seen anything
so
like that before.
So we have a little Bronx reunion here on the air. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, before the show, Nancy, I don't want to talk. I can't say anything. You give her a microphone, you can't shut her up. No, I'm kidding. Nancy, what was Ray like back then when you first met him? What was your impression? We're going to hear from him in a second.
He's extremely dynamic, very good-looking. he still has that. He was a weightlifter, and he just had this presence when, remember, I was able to go into the union hall when it would have meetings, and he was when he was speaking, the crowd was just filled. It was standing. The hall was filled. It was standing room only. People love to listen to him speak.
So Ray is a good speaker, but he's also, you know, a brilliant tactician, strategist, analyst, activist, because what he's done is he's taken the union struggle out of the hands just of labor and introduced it to the consumer, introduced it to young people, way to help out by actually boycotting some of these banks and companies that are abusing their workers. And he's involved in a campaign against Coca-Cola, just to say that, invites, you know, the interest of corporate lawyers around the world. But I'm saying it. He has a website, killercoke.org. We're going to hear more about that, about the campaign against Coca-Cola. But right now, we want to meet Ray, and then we're going to tell you how you can get involved in helping to make this film that Nancy is working on about Ray Rogers and about his work. He's the man that corporations love to hate, and we're happy to have him here. Hi, Ray. Welcome to PRN. You're wearing a Killer Coke T-shirt. Tell us a little bit about your strange journey, you know, as a person who became an organizer. How did you get started, and what are you up to now?
Well, I think my greatest education, when I became a VISTA volunteer back in the late 60s and worked with the poorest of the poor in Appalachia. And I can tell you, Danny, I learned more from people who could not read or write a word than I did from all my PhD professors in college. They survived in the situation, you know, dire poverty in this country that all these PhDs wouldn't survive for a couple of weeks. And, you know, that led me into one thing or another. I got involved in a number of union struggles with the mine workers to dump the murderous Tony Boyle as the head of the mine workers. Got involved with the farm workers. And one thing led to another. And eventually I got my chance to become involved in a campaign against the J.P. Stevens textile firm. It was a company on which the film Norm Ray was based. And that's where I developed a concept that I called the corporate campaign. And if people were to look at headlines back at that time, they'd find that the CEOs of the biggest banks and insurance companies, manufacturers Hanover, New York Life, Avon Products, J.P. Stevens, were resigning from each other's boards. In a sense, that was part of the whole corporate campaign strategy. And I also recognize in struggles like at Hormel that when you get together with any group of workers, the collective knowledge, imagination, skills, and energies, they have the ability to accomplish anything if they just have some direction and some support.
And you provided that support. You also helped educate them and focus them on the people sort of behind the curtain, the people who are financing these companies. Like, wasn't there a big bank in Minnesota that you went after?
Yes, First Bank System. We were having tens of millions of dollars, and it would have eventually been hundreds of millions pulled out. Unfortunately, what was ugly about the situation was that the international union of this local, along with the leadership at the time, Lane Kirkland, the AFL-CIO, did everything they could to undermine and destroy the worker struggle. Yet we had the ability to reach out to unions not only throughout the United States, but around the world, about over 60,000, and we were drawing support, financial and organizational support, from over 3,000 unions around the country.
Some of this story was told in an Academy Award-winning documentary by Barbara Koppel, American Dream. I know the local people, they're not too thrilled with the way it came out, but nevertheless, it captures some of the frustration and the passion and the difficulty of taking on a big company like that, and the persistence of the workers there, and the role that you played, Ray, in trying to bring this issue to national attention, to try to bring this issue and make this issue not just an issue of a local one company, but an issue of economic justice. And to me, that's the direction labor has to move in. We have to show that it's not just workers who are benefiting by unions, but that unions are fighting for everybody. And that's what part of what seems to be missing to me in the whole situation today.
You know, Danny, one of the important things about unions that people don't understand, if we're to have a real flourishing democracies, you need freedom of the press, and let's face it, unless it's programs like this, freedom of the press is being lost in this country, and free trade unions. They're critical if democracies would flourish. Now, when you get involved in campaigns that also bring you into places like Latin America and other places, a strong union is just not about protecting and improving wages and benefits and safety in a job. It can mean the difference between life and death.
And we want to hear a little bit more about that, particularly about your work with the Coca-Cola workers. But I want to shift, because I have a double, triple strategy here in this particular program. I want to tell you about Ray. I want to tell you about Nancy's film and how you can help get that film made. And then I want to talk about what the implications of all of this are for the labor movement, because, you know, we've all been reading about Wisconsin, we've all been following this fight for, you know, collective bargaining rights and the like, but here's Ray basically telling us we have to go beyond that. We have to not just fight for the rights of workers to be represented, but we have to fight for economic justice in the society and try to take some sort of power away from these giant corporations that are dominating our lives. Do I get it?
Right. The slogan of my organization, Corporate Campaign Inc., is tools to confront power with power. You cannot confront powerful institutions and expect to gain any meaningful concessions unless you're backed by a significant force of power yourself.
So now you've heard Ray, and you can hear how articulate and knowledgeable he is, an amazing person. You know, I've been following his work for many years. And here comes Nancy, the photographer, who decides, you know, after being immersed in this battle out in Minnesota, that there really should be a film about Ray's work. So what's the status of it right now?
Well, I should just say that I kept in touch with Ray all those years. I worked at the New York Times for 13 years, you know, and Ray and I were always in touch during that period. Then he just asked me to photograph, actually videotape, a speech he was giving at Mount Holyoke College to students in this campaign to kick Coca-Cola off campuses around the country. And I think that's an all-girls school, right?
Yes.
and I
can verify that, yes.
It is an all-girls school. And I'm so videotaping his speech, and I just was amazed that the students were riveted to what he was saying about, you know, the crimes of Coca-Cola globally. And they were really interested in participating and kind of getting involved in this movement. And that's when I really saw that the way that he had appealed to me when I was a student was continuing all these years later. Yeah. He has gray hair now, but it doesn't matter. You know, people are students, workers, ordinary people are hungry for this kind of thing.
Yeah, he is a bit grayer than me. Anyway, the point about all of this is Nancy is making a film, and that she's been covering Ray and traveling with him and documenting him. And here's the problem. CNBC is not financing this film, okay? Neither is Time Warner. Neither is any of the big media companies in America. It's an independent film. In order to make an independent film, as I know all too well, and making Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and other films, it's tough to find financing. It's tough to actually make these movies happen. The more controversial they are, the more challenging of power they are, the less money seems to be available for them. But now, online, there are ways to raise money from people to help make films like this happen. And Nancy and your film is now on something called what? Indiegogo?
Indiegogo.
And what is Indiegogo?
It's a crowdfunding platform, they call it. So I have a trailer on the site, and I have a goal. I'm trying to raise $18,000 for this part of it. I'm still in production. We would like to travel to Colombia, South America, where some of these crimes have been committed. People can donate, contribute an amount of money starting at $10, and they can get various perks at the site, T-shirts, pins, DVDs, my photographic prints, which I'm also offering for different contributions.
How about a photograph of you? No? Anyway, here's the thing. You can help Nancy and Ray get this film made, and you can do it starting with at the $10 level. I guess you donate through PayPal. Is direct
contribution.
Direct contributions.
But anyway, with a credit card. And there's a PayPal if you need to have a tax-deductible donation.
Okay, so here's the URL. I'm going to give it to you once. We're going to give it to you again later. So please write this down as a way you can get involved. You know, when films are made, you often see a list of producers, of funders at the end of documentaries, this foundation, that foundation, all the rest of it. But when it comes to films like this, you don't see big lists like that unless the people get involved to help make this film. That's what I'm appealing for today. We're turning this program into a mini radiothon for this film. And here's the number to call, the URL to write to or to reach, tinyurl.com/TheRayProject. Easy to remember. tinyurl.com/TheRayProject. And we'll give that to you again. But we would really like it if this radio show and this network, Progressive Radio Network, can help support progressive media projects like Nancy's project and Ray's project here to try to get this story made, to try to get it distributed, to try to get people to see it, to be inspired by it, and to act in solidarity with it. And that's really what my purpose is here today in having them on. I have never tried to do that. You know, it'd be hard for me to do this for my own films because that's considered, quote, self-promotional. But this isn't. This is something that really is meaningful. And at this time of labor, convulsive labor struggles, unions under attack, people like Ray Rogers and his voice really deserve to be heard. Let's face it. We need leadership. And we're not getting it from the traditional leaders. Now, there is some improvements at the AFL-CIO. I don't want to put everybody down and say only Ray has the truth, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, we saw the tremendous turnout in Wisconsin to support the workers there, but we've got to go beyond that. And one way to go beyond that is to get this film made so more people can find out about Ray Rogers. I'm sorry I'm dominating the microphone here, but this is called spieling, Ray, you know, pitching, you know, for this film. And I'm trying to do it because I really believe in it. Now, you've been involved in, you know, the other day I'll tell a story. We had a little luncheon, you know, where I was sort of being paid off to do this program. You know, it wasn't great food, in my opinion, but nevertheless, it was nice. And, you know, so they say, well, what do you want to drink? And I was going to have a beer, but it was lunchtime, so I said a Diet Coke, and Ray went, a Diet Coke? No way, Jose! You know, and suddenly I realized I was, instinctively going for a product that Ray is boycotting, you know? That was talking about politically incorrect. So, Ray, what is it about Coca-Cola What did you have you learned about Coca-Cola? Why are you involved in this campaign? What does it mean, KillerCoke.org?
Well, first of all, Coca-Cola, which is supposed to be viewed as an American icon, should be viewed as an American criminal. This company operates like a criminal syndicate with impunity. And when I talk about the world of Coca-Cola, I'm talking about a world that is full of lies, deception, immorality, corruption, and widespread labor, human rights, and environmental abuses. We initially got involved, and when people came to me and said, Ray, we have a serious life and death situation. We really need your help, but we don't have any resources. At that time, I wanted to go after ExxonMobil, but I would have needed a lot of resources. So we decided to take Coke on and build a campaign from grassroots up. And it was focusing on the issues of the systematic intimidation, kidnapping, torture, and murder of union leaders in Colombia to crush their union, Sinaltonal. Yes, I am accusing Coca-Cola as being complicit in this activity, and their managers at the Coke bottling plants in Colombia, as well as now in Guatemala. There have been several lawsuits. There's one outstanding right now with respect to Guatemala. Our campaign has gone a number of directions. We've gotten Coke kicked out of about 5 dozen colleges and universities. The biggest one was Rutgers. Another big one was the State University of New York in Stony Brook. Those two universities had exclusive contracts where the only beverage you could get on campus was a Coca-Cola beverage. Now there are no Coke beverages. The loss of those two contracts are costing this company not only tens of millions of dollars in losses and revenues, but also loss in building their brand name. Labor unions, the head of the United Auto Workers, the new fellow, when you mentioned improvements at the AFL-CIO, Bob King. On November, he announced at a rally where 900 people were watching the film The Coca-Cola Case, about the very things I'm talking about in Colombia, and he announced that the UAW is going to be Coke-free. We're going to get Coke kicked out of our international and call on all of our locals, get Coke kicked out of all their locals and out of all their shops. We're going to have another major union making the same announcement very soon. Here in New York, we've got some big unions. The biggest AFSCME local has done the same thing, and so that's some of the issues involved here.
Well, I think whenever I think of Latin American Coca-Cola, there's a story I was told, which is I was told in Cuba when I visited Cuba. Apparently, you know, Coca-Cola has always been not just a company but a brand, a symbol of American imperialism in many parts of the world. And Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola have battled for territory. Nixon was a Pepsi man. You know, a Carter was a Coke man. Whatever. There's books about all of this. And in Cuba, I was told that there was a period in which Che Guevara decided that the way that he had to bring down Coca-Cola, and the way to do it was to find the formula for Coca-Cola, the secret formula, supposedly, for how Coke is made. And he apparently was involved, and this is unconfirmable, I'll tell you anyway because it's juicy, you know. He apparently had an affair going with some woman who came to Cuba, was enthralled by, you know, this revolucionario, Comandante Che Guevara, you know, El Che, as they call him in Cuba. And he was the Minister of Industry in Cuba. And reportedly, she somehow was connected to the Coca-Cola family in some way, and he got hold of the Coca-Cola formula, or thought he had it. And so a company in a secret project somewhere in Camagüey in Cuba was actually trying to make Coca-Cola and demystify this formula so that they could take away this valuable asset from the Coca-Cola company. And so the day arrived, the Comandante Che Guevara showed up at the factory. The workers took the Coca-Cola. They gave him a glass of it, you know. He tasted it, he put it in his mouth, and he spit it out. He said, "You guys blew it. This is shit. We don't want this. This is not really the real Coca-Cola," and the whole project was killed. But anyway, that was an effort to bring down Coca-Cola in another era. I don't know if it's true or not, but it sounds pretty good.
It is shit. You are right. It still is, and it's very unhealthy.
But anyway, Ray, I mean, you're against Coca-Cola. You're fighting in many different campaigns. You've gone to the... What happens when you go to the annual meeting of these companies? What happens there?
Well, in the case of 2004, I got assaulted from behind, a really serious assault. And if it wasn't because of my weightlifting all these years, I'd probably be sitting in a wheelchair right now. And the CEO was up on the podium and says, security, stand down. We've made a mistake. This was Coca-Cola's people. Now, what happened, we just came out of an annual meeting in Atlanta, and I get up to raise a question. And all I can say is that right now, all this week, we are getting major coverage in the Mexican press. Why? Because, again, I caught the CEO lying to stockholders. And I will say right now in your program that Muhtar Kent, the chairman and CEO of the Coca-Cola company, is lying to the investment community and to stockholders about a situation in Mexico, about situations in Guatemala and in India and other places in the world that could cost this company billions of dollars in fines, restitution, damages, and loss of brand value. And he's lying. And I called him a liar. And
In Spanish, we go mentira. Okay, we use that term. We just write
mentirosa.
Sí, claro.
What they're doing.
Gusto, sí.
Right, and the biggest shareholder, by the way, in Coca-Cola is Warren Buffett. And he was on the board of Coca-Cola for many years. And I would claim that our campaign led to his leaving the Coca-Cola.
The Oracle of Omaha?
The Oracle of Omaha makes a lot of his money on the backs of exploitation of children, workers.
Okay, so now we've defamed several companies and several people. Before you sue me, corporate lawyers, I'd be happy to read a brief statement of response from you, the interests of fairness, free press, and not getting sued. So I'd be happy to do that. But I hear you, Ray, and this is something that people are totally uneducated about. You must realize that people drink this drink. They have no idea what this company is. They have no idea about what's going on behind the scenes, because these companies advertise so much in the media, on television and radio and online.
Danny, $3 billion a year in advertising by Coca-Cola to create an image and reality that masks the ugly reality that is this company.
Well, there you go. So it's not surprising that people don't really know about it, which brings us back to our project here that Nancy has come asking for help for, which is this film. Now, tell us again the title of the film, Nancy, how people can help, why they must help now.
It's called The Man Corporations Love to Hate. He's the man. simply going to Indiegogo at
tinyurl.com/TheRayProject. That's the shorter URL.
Shorter. Or going to Indiegogo and searching The Man Corporations Love to Hate is another way.
So there's a way in which you can help Nancy reach her goal so we can make this film, so she can make this film and get this film out, and that more people can become familiar with Ray and his work. Now, just in the final minutes that we have available here, Ray, your reaction to this uprising in Wisconsin and what's happening with labor and what direction labor has to move.
Well, with respect to the public sector, if you say who runs government, who's controlling government, who are the big players, it's big business. So it's one thing about demonstrating against these politicians, and yes, you want to be involved in political action to make sure they don't get reelected, but you have to take your fight to the business community on these public sector fights. That means the banks, the insurance companies, the investment companies, the corporations. For example, in New York, I did two campaigns. One got a lot of attention. One settled a very serious problem with state workers behind the scenes. It was all about how to understand how to bring the private sector into these public sector fights. One was a big transit fight in 1999, where the New York Times said transit workers got the best contract of any public workers in a decade in New York. That was my campaign. And what people should have been looking was thousands of people demonstrating with signs. One that said, "We want our fair share, not a fair hike." That got the consumers on your side. Number two, public welfare, not corporate welfare. Public services, not corporate welfare. Look at the hundreds of millions of dollars that's going into corporate welfare by these multi-billion-dollar companies given to them by people like Giuliani, the Pataki's, the Bloombergs, etc.
Well, you know, the point here is that labor in its fights has to champion the public interest, not just the narrow interests of labor in terms of wages, hours, and working conditions. I mean, the teachers union used to have a slogan, "Teachers want what children need." And that seemed to get buried into "what teachers want, what teachers need." And I think that led to a tremendous resentment against teachers. No, Robert? We're having trouble reaching our next guest. I want to make sure that the number is correct, so we're going to try him again. At any rate, we ask you to stay on with us a little bit more.
All right, Danny, can I say one thing on the public sector? We were very instrumental in helping to get Kathy Black booted and bring attention to her. She was on the board of Coca-Cola, raking in millions of dollars since 1993. And she was a big promoter and fought every step of the way with Coke not to ban these unhealthy drinks going into these children. So she was working to not only mass market to children, but she's also been involved where children are involved in hazardous child labor in the fields of El Salvador, harvesting sugar cane for Coke sugar supplies, these sort of things. She was, not only was she unqualified, she was unfit to serve as a school chancellor.
Well, how many of you heard that Catherine Black, former chancellor of the city's school system, was on the board of Coca-Cola? I'm hearing it for the first time right here. I didn't know that. And, you know, and of course...
And he was trying to get the word out. He informed the New York Times and
we got a couple of good articles, actually. Juan Gonzalez did a heck of a piece.
In the Daily News,
yeah, in the
right?
Daily News, yeah. And the New York Times followed up. But, Danny, one thing I'd like to say about this gutsy filmmaker here, so that when people think, it's not just about supporting a film she's making, that I'm the person she's focusing on, but what she is a filmmaker. She's like the war correspondent for workers. When I first met Nancy, shortly thereafter, I called her to help out something with farm workers, who I've been very much involved with over the years, including today. She went into a mushroom plant as this young photographer, snuck in, hid in the dark, to get photographs of the terrible working conditions in this mushroom plant.
And so there you go. I mean, again, tinyurl.com/The Ray Project, Nancy's film about the man corporations love to hate. We're going to be hearing a little bit more. I guess Ray's going to stick with us if we can't reach Robert Young Pelton. We're trying to reach him now. Matt, we'd like to go to our break now, and we're going to do so with a classic song from the labor movement.
What force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
This is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business, or buying a house, or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. and click on the link to the expat files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
I'm Steve Lindman. I host the Progressive Radio News Hour. It's an in-depth truth hour, an antidote to government and corporate managed news and infotainment on the most important world and national issues affecting everyone. Distinguished guests are featured regularly to provide cutting-edge commentary and analysis not available from the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation on what everyone needs to know. The Progressive Radio News Hour is Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network, of course. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we owe it all to you.
So what do you think of my anthem there, Ray? That's from the film In Debt We Trust that I made in 2006, warning of the financial crisis. The response in the media was, you know, I was a doom and gloomer. I was an alarmist. I didn't know what I was talking about. Then suddenly, when the market smelted down, I went from being a zero to a hero. You're a genius. How did you know? Nobody knew. Well, you know, it wasn't like I was hardly the only one. But the point is that covering and writing about and organizing around economic issues is difficult because the issues of the economy and of who has power in our society are not really covered very well. In other words, they have a business section which is intended for people in business, not for the general public. So if you don't understand, you know, some of the phraseology, it tunes you out. You know, you don't understand how money works or what it's about. I mean, do you find that also?
Oh, I sure do. You read a corporation's proxy statement. Now, most of these statements you'll find is about all the money, all the special ways that these corporate executives can get more and more money. But you read these statements and you say, well, how could even a lawyer understand these, let alone a regular individual? But when I just listened to your song, you were talking about a lot of corporate criminals. And if you really want to read a lot about all the names you met, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, there's a publication called Corporate Crime Reporter, one of the best publications out there. And you'll see the names of the companies that you mentioned quite often in Corporate Crime Reporter because they're criminals.
Also, my own book, The Crime of Our Time, which has a lot more detail about these financial crimes you know, of course, this is central to what's happening. This whole foreclosure crisis is central to the financial crisis. And these connections, though, aren't made very often, you know. And so what we need to do is somehow educate people while organizing them and trying to make something happen. I've been advocating, you know, a jail out of Wall Street people, not a bailout. And so, you know, that's partly what we're doing. Ray Rogers, Nancy, thank you. Please stick around and listen in to this segment, because we're moving now from the domestic to the international to the global through the eyes of a man who I came to know some years back, who is like brave, maybe crazy, maybe insane. I don't know. But, you know, his interest is in going to the toughest places in the world, the most dangerous places in the world, which he's written about. So, Robert Young Pelton, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey.
How you doing?
Great, man. I thought we might have missed you. No, guys, stay and listen. So, let's tell people a little bit about who you are and what you're doing, and then I have a bunch of questions and to ask you.
Well, right now I've got a project in Somalia called Somalia Report, which is a ground-based information website. If you go to SomaliaReport.com, you'll see it. But essentially, we run a network of about 60 local Somalis, and we cover pirates, Al-Shabaab, all the stuff that goes on in Somalia that you don't read about in the regular media. And, of course, I also do my documentaries and my books, and like to goof off as much as I can.
and your website, comebackalive.com, which is really a must read. I mean, this guy has been there and done that. Now, Robert, last Sunday night, President Obama commands, the television networks of the world, basically, and announces that we have killed Osama bin Laden. And this is an issue that you've been following closely for many years. You've been in Afghanistan. What was your reaction to this, and what's your thinking about it?
Well, more importantly, I've been in Pakistan, where bin Laden has always been. And I'm surprised it's taken them that long to actually locate him and find him, because if you go through my public statement since 2002, I've been telling people that, you know, the war is in Pakistan. Bin Laden is in Pakistan, and he's most likely being protected by either the ISI, which is the intelligence agency, or by the government, or both. Bin Laden went to Pakistan in 1979. He really has very, very little connections with Afghanistan, but he has very strong connections with Pakistan, and, of course, with the Pakistani ISI. So just like any other animal you hunt, you go to see where it waters, and Bin Laden waters at the Pakistani ISI cash machine, so that's exactly where
the ATM machine, right? I probably had one in that quote mansion, which wasn't such a mansion. Now, just let's remind people about your kind of connection in a way to this story, because you were there, were you not, in the early days of the battle in Afghanistan after 9/11, the whole Mazar-e-Sharif, John Walker Lind. Tell people about what you were doing there and what you observed.
Well, my relationship with Afghanistan and Pakistan actually started back in 1995, when I was, if not the first, one of the first people to set up interviews with the head shir of the Taliban, when they were just before they were getting ready to attack Kabul. And I was also in Afghanistan right after September 11th. I was invited to join the war by General Dostum, and he had a special forces group with him, the guys that fought on horseback. And I was there during the Kalijangi battle, and asked Dostum to bring the survivors out because I wanted to meet them. And so after they were trapped in this basement and they tried to burn them and flood them.
That was this prison, right? Like a medieval-type prison? That
it wasn't actually a prison. It was a garrison. It was
a garrison, okay.
1898 as a kind of a horse garrison. It's sort of a what they call a Vauban-style fort, which was, you know, it looked very nice, but it's typical in that area to impress people. It's kind of an old-fashioned-looking medieval fort, but it was actually a garrison for horses and for, of course, soldiers. And there was actually a bomb shelter built right smack in the middle, which was used as a schoolhouse, but this is where about 86 jihadis hid after the initial shootout where Mike Spann was killed.
And Mike Spann was a CIA guy.
It was actually a well-fortified bomb shelter, which is why those guys survived for an entire week. But in any case, I met these survivors who were driven to where I was, and about half of them were seriously wounded, and they were all very hypothermic. They were taken to a hospital, and that's when one of the Dawson's guys ran over and said there's an American there. And at that time, we didn't know what happened to Mike Spann, so I just went over to see who it was, and it turned out to be this kid, John Walker Lind. And then you saw the interview on CNN, but then I took him home with me because I was concerned that he might be killed that night, and then he vanished. So that was my connection to Kalajungi.
So you saved his life, John Walker Lind, who's now serving a sentence here in the United States, and people are asking that he be freed. What was he like? I mean, there in the middle of this war, what was your impression of this kid from California?
He was the second Irish-American jihadi I had known. I had gone into Chechnya with an American jihadi that had trained in Midland's camp. So he struck me as kind of a wussy kid. You know, he wasn't a tough guy. And he was always complaining about this and that. And, you know, he didn't strike me as someone that was that bellicose. But the thing that kind of shocked me was that he was truly in love with Al-Qaeda. He called it Ansar, which is the correct name. And
what is the correct name again? I'm sorry. Just explain that to us.
Well, bin Laden went over there in the, you know, during the war with the Russians, and his job was specifically to bring over Arab-speaking volunteers to fight against the Russians. And he worked for Abdullah Azam in Peshawar in Pakistan in a nice house. And he called that group Al-Ansar, which is the helpers. The word Al-Qaeda actually refers to the book that he meticulously filled out with all these jihadis' names and addresses and passport numbers. And when he left Afghanistan, right towards when the Russians were leaving, he took that book with him, and that became sort of this networking, I guess the first Facebook of terrorism, which then became Al-Qaeda, because he had all these trained people who could all network. When he went back to Afghanistan, it was 1996, and I was actually living down the road from him in Jalalabad. He lived in a house just at the end of the... If you go to the checkpoint and you go left at the end of Jalalabad, that's where he used to live. And he and his people used to drive through town like gangsters in their Hiluxes and Land Cruisers. But he was always kind of a minor character. He was sort of a guy on the run, didn't have a citizenship, and had to hide out somewhere because he couldn't travel. But when he escaped in December of 2001, I think it was the 9th.
This is through Tora Bora?
Yeah, he took horses over the mountains, went to Parchinar in Pakistan, then drove to Peshawar, which is exactly where he lived for 10 years when he worked there. And then for a while, I went there in 2003 to look for him, and I found Zawahiri, but nobody had seen bin Laden, which I thought was very unusual, which meant that he had gone to ground. And when you go to ground in Afghanistan or Pakistan, that means you're living in a very large compound that has the protection of some large person, which would either be a warlord or the government. So I thought it very strange. Now, I do know that he was moving around Chitral. There were some people that insisted that he was in Chitral. These are people that had worked with him. And then when the earthquake happened in Kashmir in 2005, he magically stopped making videos and then moved into this house, which was actually owned by Harakat al-Mujahideen, which is a terrorist group that supports the fight in Kashmir. And it's a safe house that they use for meetings and people staying. And that's where he sat ever since.
Well, what's interesting is that some Afghan agents and the Pakistanis claim they told the United States about that house back in 2005. I've written an article about this in my blog at newsdissector.com/blog. I'd love you to read it. I've also posted it on a bunch of websites. It's called The Raid. And basically it says, you know, is this a media operation or a military operation? And my argument is, you know, that they had knowledge. And I actually had written the article last night. And then before I went to sleep, the Washington Post had a breaking news story that the CIA had a special base in, you know, that town there with the Pakistan Military Academy, and were monitoring that house. So they knew he was there, it seems like, and people told him that he was there back in 2009.
Well, I don't know if they knew he was there. That house was supervised by Al-Libi, who was killed, and then Ilyas Kashmiri, who was a very senior member of Al-Qaeda, took over the construction and supervision. So it was very clear to me that this was a known safe house. Now, the question is, who's inside? Well, if you don't come in or out, it's very hard to get informants to tell you who's in the house. So they just would have assumed that it's just like any other safe house. It was there to protect people. But I think the secret was that bin Laden stayed inside all the time. He didn't actually go in or out. But I don't think they knew specifically where he was, or else they would have called him a predator or an airstrike. I think they had to trace this courier, these two brothers, and I think when all their intelligence came together, they suddenly went, oh, damn, he's in that house.
So what about the timing of this raid? I mean, you're suggesting that they just found this out, right? Or
well, the reason I know that is because two things. One is they send in humans, which means they wanted to confirm that there was someone of interest in that house. If they would have known through a predator or satellites or whatever that it was Bin Laden, they would have used an airstrike because it would have been politically easier to explain. The second thing is that normally when you kill people, you don't tell anybody for a week because you want to gather as much data and you want to capture. So when they killed, you remember Zarqawi was killed in an air raid by McChrystal's folks in JSOC. They didn't tell anybody for almost a week because they wanted to go exploit the data they found on the laptop and go get all those other people before they knew what was going on. So the fact that they did this so quickly and then released the information so quickly tells me that they were taking a flyer, and they used SEAL Team 6. And SEAL Team 6 is a very, very good intelligence gathering group in sort of kinetic activities.
Now, you've met these covert action operators, haven't
Sure.
you?
Mm-hmm.
What are they like? I mean,
well, the SEALs are dudes, you know. They usually have sideburns, and they come in every shape and size, and they're pretty laid back, and you'd be hard-pressed to guess that they're military. They usually go in very quick, blow stuff up, and go home. They're not designed to be like special forces where you sit on the ground and train people. They typically work in groups, so it's not just SEALs. You'll have some CIA special activities folks. You might have some special forces. You might have Rangers. You might be flown in by the 160th Air Group. So they do a lot of joint operations under the JSOC banner. But in this particular case, I think they were working directly under the CIA Special Activities Division because it was a very large contingent of SEALs. And, you know, the joke is, how many SEALs does it take to shoot an unarmed middle-aged man in the face? Well, 90 or 80.
They brought a dog with them as well, apparently.
Yeah, the dog, who knows? If somebody was hiding in the house, I'm sure you could ferret it out. Because typically these houses have tunnels. And in the past, when they raid these houses in the tribal areas, there are tunnels that go almost a half a mile.
It's interesting how they had this, what the New York Times is calling a stealthier helicopter there, which also crashed. I mean, this is back, reminded me of Iran, you know, where
right.
Jimmy Carter's hostage rescue mission, you know, the helicopters got sand in them and crashed, we were told. And apparently this whole, you know, SEAL Team 6 was a response to make sure that never happened again. And here we go. I mean, this mission could have been aborted somehow.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Well, when they say stealth, it's very hard to have a stealth helicopter. But I think this helicopter was quieter than most, but when one of these Blackhawks lands in your backyard, that's not necessarily stealthy.
Right. So were you surprised by this, or you assumed this was going to happen at some point?
Well, it's going to happen at some point because there is so much intense pressure on Pakistan ever since they started the Predator program and ever since we started moving contractors and CIA people in there to launch the Predator campaign. The thing that struck me is odd, though, if you remember the guy that was arrested for shooting two Pakistanis,
right?
Remember they suspended all the Predator strikes, and there was a very strange lull in American-Pakistani relationship. And I almost had the sense that we were busted at that point, that they knew we were tracking Bin Laden, and they had to come up with some way to kick all these CIA and special activities people out of the country, because most people forget that incident, but if you look at the Predator strikes, they literally stopped while this fellow, and I forget his name, unfortunately, but while he was on trial, and he worked for the agency. So I almost sense that Pakistan knew we were on the trail of Bin Laden, and they tried to come up with any excuse to kick out all the American assets.
Don't people suspect you as being CIA, Robert?
No, I'm too tall and good-looking for that. No, actually, I've been told two things. One, I would be the perfect spy because everybody knows who I am and I write books and do TV shows and people recognize me. Another, I'd be a terrible spy because I stick out like a sore thumb and only speak about two or three languages. But I don't know. I mean, A lot of people work for the agency, and they're very smart, very hardworking, intelligent people. I'm not one of them.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm learning more from this conversation than I have in a week of, media blather about this. I mean, it's, you know, all this talk about, well, it's all thanks to waterboarding that we were able to find him. That seems to be totally bogus.
Well, if you imagine how many pieces of intelligence are floating around since September 11th and how many of them are just crap and how many of them are actually useful, I think that's the problem. If you took everybody in Gitmo and waterboarded them every day, you'd have millions and millions of bits of information of which you wouldn't have a clue which was correct and which was incorrect.
So just processing all of this stuff and interpreting it and understanding it takes a lot of work, maybe beyond the capacity. I mean,
you need humans. You need people on the ground looking, watching, talking, living, and you need people who want to get rid of that person on your side.
So prediction. Do you think that this incident is going to in any way lead to an end to the war in Afghanistan? I mean, do you think it's going to creating? I mean, there's been a lot of theories now that this is something that, you know, is convenient because now there's a pretext for maybe ending the war. On the other hand, there seemed to be a lot of noise about the war not only continuing but expanding. So what is your take? What do you think?
Well, here's my opinion of this. You know, the eye on the prize is Iran. It's Afghanistan and Iraq are just sideshows. The war in Afghanistan, when Obama came into power, he said shut it down. And you've got to remember, he fired 2 four-star generals who wanted to ramp up the war. And he has no interest. It's too politically costly and it's too financially costly. And our real goal is Iran. For some strange reason, ever since the 80s, we've been fixated on Iran. So what Iraq and Afghanistan give you are forward operating bases in which you can attack and observe and deal with Iran. And Iran is terrified of us, and we're terrified of them, and neither one of us wants to make a move. But, you know, just from the rhetoric you read for the last 10 years, they're always trying to find a reason to bomb the hell out of Iran or do something in Iran. So
right,
what you're going to see is the war is going to be shut down in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we'll maintain our forward listening bases in Turkey and Iraq.
I was just in Iran, Robert, you know, and while I was there, there were all these exercises that were being reported, kind of defensive exercises. There seems to be a lot of people are rattled there, and certainly the sanctions are having an impact. But, you know, this whole question about whether or not they want to do battle with Iran, this is something Israel seems to want. I don't know. The U.S. seems to want it, too, to the degree Israel wants it, but then maybe not. At any rate, these are issues that we can return to. I'm so happy that I thought about, hey, who would know about this? I said, Robert Young Pelton. If anybody in America has any indication of the environment, the ambiance, what's actually happening, it's you. Your website, again, tell us.
It's the SomaliaReport.com, or you can go to ComeBackAlive.com.
And Robert Young Pelton, you know, I'm still grateful for your working with me on my WMD film, WMD Pleasure. Weapons of Mass Deception. I see aspects of this operation being spun as a media operation being spun for political reasons. I write about that in my blog at newsdissector.com/blog, but also on op-ed news at this info site, reportergary.com, many other places, and here on the Progressive Radio Network.com site. Gary Noll just read it aloud on the radio. So I'm following these events. I hope we can be in closer touch. Robert, I want to thank you so much again for coming on the show today. Also, Ray Rogers, Nancy Sisel, their great film that they're in the process of making. Once again, you can help them by going to tinyurl.com/TheRayProject, if you will. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. You can read me every day at mediachannel.org or newsdissector.com/blog. Information about my film is on Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I'm looking for some interns, some people who might want to help with this outreach effort that we're making and to improve our website and other work like good work like that in terms of progressive media. So please get in touch with me. Thank you so much for listening. I think it's time for me to go today.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers paid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stocks, empty wallets, and empty shops. And bank walk in the AAA, grandpa loses 401k.